This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte changes and grows a little bit every day as apartments spring up in the urban core and developers build new homes in the suburbs. It should come as no surprise that new businesses are created to serve the people living there, and that includes restaurants. The number and variety of restaurants continues to multiply, so periodically we invite the city's restaurant critics to share their opinions on these new eating opportunities and to revisit some of the tried and true Charlotte eateries. Today is that day. Hope you starved yourself yesterday. And we'll also hear about dining and drinking trends and how the increasing number of chefs in our region are altering or is altering the dining scene. Is or are? What do you think?
Is,
thank you.
Increasing number is.
All right, thank you. Dishing on dining here with an eye toward putting good money toward good food are Helen Schwab and Tricia Childress. Helen is the restaurant writer for the Charlotte Observer. Been doing it for years.
Mm-hmm.
And Helen...
And yet I remain so youthful looking.
Yes. And Tricia is restaurant critic for Creative Loafing and associate professor at Johnson-Wales University. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Prior to the recession, eateries were springing up left and right. Recession seemed to have slowed things down a bit. Are the number and variety of restaurants growing now as fast as they were prior to the recession? Do we know?
If only I had done that statistical math before I came.
You never know what I'm going to ask, do you?
You're,
it's the danger of being here.
Our dangerous radio, Mike. I think that I would say the growth is there. It is a different kind of growth.
How so?
I agree with that.
How so?
People aren't opening. I mean, what was happening then, right before the recession, was high-end, top-dollar kinds of places. Virtually no one opens those now.
Hmm. So are we medium dollar, low dollar, what medium end, if that's such a thing? I mean, what are we opening today?
I think the change has been with the dynamics of the people who work in the city. And before the market collapsed, I think that bankers were the way to go, and going out, taking your clients out for expensive steak dinners and that kind of thing. That was great. And now we have this huge mass of people that are between the ages of 20 and 35, and they just want to go in and eat. And it may be counter service. It may be just fast casual. But
breweries.
You know, yeah. Well,
a lot
yeah.
of breweries. Yeah.
Breweries. Absolutely.
Is that a function of the economy, the new economy, or is it a function of the fact like the breweries are really catering to the explosion of millennials? Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, when Tom Condren and Matt Parra were opening the Liberty, I remember them talking about, you know, so the reality is the reason we want to do this sort of thing is that you can buy a really good beer for $6, mm-hmm. a really good high-end, top-of-the-line, shishi beer, $6. Then, I mean, now it's more. And you couldn't touch wine in retail for less than $9 or $10. Mm-hmm. And so the difference is that... illustrates the difference. People want quality, and I think there's an increasing interest and concern and passion for really high-end things. So what can we do high-end that doesn't cost everybody the kind of money that wine does? And which is, you know, beside the point that you can do beer and you can't do wine just at the drop of a hat. So there's lots of reasons for it. I think millennials are interested, and they don't have the paychecks that bankers did, mm-hmm. But they care about quality. So I think that's why you're seeing more small chef-driven places that are doing, like Fudo Buddha is a great example, the Robin House that's on the light rail line. I mean less expensive, really beautiful food.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to be a meat and three, and then we got liquor by the drink in restaurants, and that caused things to change. Johnson and Wales arrived mm-hmm. several years ago. We were told that would cause the eating scene to change, and I think it has. And all this seemed to come about at about the same time that Americans became interested in food beyond macaroni and cheese and, you know, Kraft's boxes of spaghetti. And then chef-driven restaurants became hot places to eat. We seem to be consumed with food. And I was reading in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. I'm about 6 weeks behind. They just pile up.
They're so big. You can't
they are.
I wish there were smaller papers. papers that had lots of news that weren't so big.
But the food TV networks. Food TV networks began to spring up all over the place. And one of the beneficiaries of that was a guy named Alton Brown, who is a food star on the Food Network. And he told the New York Times that 10 years ago, food in America was like sex was in the 70s. Our last decadent act. But today we've moved to the 80s and what he sees as a potentially appropriate austerity, a move away from food as pornography. I'm just curious about what your thoughts are on that.
So wait, it replaced sex, but he doesn't want porno?
I don't know.
The metaphors too much to wade through. So let's dispense with those and say, I think there is a decadent quality. I think there is a visceral, passionate, sweat-drenched excitement about food, yes. But I think that's because we know more about it. We care more about it. We're willing to spend more percentage of our dollar on it now because we are starting to get the difference between a tomato in season grown here and...
But I also think that it has to do with what happened to the food pre-1980 with all the additives that were added. I think people are very conscious of wanting the freshness, stuff that doesn't have other things in it.
Well, I'm curious about this because just before we started the program, you were talking about teaching your writing students at Johnson & Wales who all want to write columns about food.
Well, those would be the food writers, not all the students.
All right, well, the food writers want to write about food in a way that it was written about in newspapers in the 1950s and 60s, these long articles which no longer exist because just like in the movie business and in the theater business, nobody really cares what critics think anymore because they can get that information on Facebook or Twitter from people who are equally qualified as you.
So I appreciate the sarcasm, the dripping sarcasm there. But I think the Observer runs full reviews. We still do that. And they do extremely well with readers. We know this. I mean, we have data. So I think there is still an appetite, for this kind of coverage. I think fewer places are willing to devote the dollars that it costs
You didn't let me get to my question.
Okay, I'm
And
so
the
sorry.
Question was, if we're so interested in food, and we love food, and we know more about food than we've ever known before about food, why do we want to read about it? Why wouldn't we want to have 36 column inches from a qualified restaurant critic who really knows what they're eating, what they're talking about, what they're writing
I think
about?
We do. I'm saying that's why I still have a job. Because the Observer sees data that tells us readers love in-depth reviews and they want an expert voice.
But I brought this up because Tricia said just before the show that doesn't exist anymore.
No, that the reviews that are out there are heavily researched. I mean, I'm always surprised to find out that there's like an interest in something I wrote about a couple of years ago and there's something going, it's like, why now? But so that's out there. It's just that it's a very, people still go for the more professional review, I believe, because I personally like to shine lights on places that usually don't get any buzz at all. Sometimes I'm writing about places that no one has written about. And that, to me, is the joy of doing what I do.
How do you find these places?
Driving the cars, but I also have connections within the international community, and I talk to them about where they eat and trying to find out more about what's going on in their communities and being aware of who's coming here. So, for example, it's really surprising that over 51% of all the immigrant population in Charlotte is Latino, and specifically they're from Mexico, Honduras, and El Salvador, which means that we have pupusas all over the place. And there's a lot of Charlatans that are not familiar with pupusas.
I'm not.
So pupusas are this great street food from El Salvador. It's just it's cornmeal, really fine cornmeal, made into a dough that you can put cheese in. It's basically grilled cheese, hot off the grill. Who doesn't like that? It's $1.25.
Or a stuffed corn cake.
Or you can put
a really fine meal stuffed corn cake.
Right, you can put cheese, other things, beans in them. You can put all kinds of things in them.
I think there's more interest in that from millennials or snake people.
Sometimes they don't even know where they are.
Yes.
That's the whole thing is that they do not know where they are. The other day at Johnson & Wales, I put a map on the on the board to show them where the areas are where the immigrants live. And I'm like, you guys are looking in the wrong places for if you want to find this other kinds of food. You have to go to the places that are heavily shaded because people who move here are going to have
heavily
food
shaded on the map.
Yeah, heavily shaded on the map. Right, heavily shaded. Yeah, heavily shaded on the map. Well, and but to find the foods and everything. You know, it's like I really tell all my baking and pastry students that they need to go down to Stallings, to Grand Asia Market, because it's just an amazing Chinese bakery down there.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask this much later in the program, but since you're bringing it up now, we do have an explosion of foods from other places because of immigrant population.
Thank you for not calling it ethnic, because ethnic we despise as a word, basically.
All right.
Non-American.
But because we
non-traditional
but because
American.
We have that, when we come back, I want to talk about how you, as Native Americans, judge food from other countries that you're not really aware of until you eat it in these restaurants here in Charlotte. We'll do that when we come back here on Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about restaurants and food and whatnot with Helen Schwab, restaurant writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Tricia Childress, restaurant critic for Creative Loafing and associate professor at Johnson & Wales University. So when you go out to these restaurants that are springing up all over the place that are bringing new foods to this country and to this city, how do you judge them? I mean, you just mentioned, you referenced Guatemalan food a second ago.
El Salvadorian food.
What do you know about that, about Vietnamese food, about Ethiopian food? How can you judge it?
So for me, I'm really lucky because I've traveled a lot. Mm-hmm. And some of the places that I found because I love the food in the countries that I travel to. Last summer, for example, I went to Portugal with that direct flight from Charlotte, which is no longer here, direct flight from Charlotte to Lisbon. And when you get there, they have these morning pastries called natas, which is a custard-filled pastry, which there's a shop in Lisbon that sells over 20,000 of them a day. This is how common and popular they are. So, of course, when I came back...
As soon as Portuguese opens here,
As soon as I came back, I remember there had been a Portuguese baker at Las Delicias, and then he had moved and taken over and bought the Brazilian bakery, Tropica. And I'm like, so Rui, do you make natas? He goes, yes, three times a week. So in Charlotte, you can get this Lisbon pastry on Monroe Road.
And because you've had it there.
Because I had it there and I became addicted to it, I sought it out.
But have you been to Vietnam?
I have not been to Vietnam.
Okay, and we have plenty of Vietnamese restaurants.
Right, we do.
Have you been to Thailand? We have plenty of Thai restaurants.
Well, so that's assuming that, I mean, and travel is definitely a key piece. So there's nothing like having pizza in Naples to inform your... But it's not as if the food can only be made in Thailand. Mm-hmm. The ingredients that can only be had in Thailand or in Italy do make the food different. But people cooking it here that are from Thailand, that's similar. So if you've had it in New York, if these are Thai people cooking authentic, quote-unquote authentic, because I remember we had a big kerfuffle at the Observer because I had described pozole as having, I'm trying to remember, I think this is it, as having hominy in it. And somebody called and said, my mother's pozole never had hominy in it. And the next person, so that's not authentic. And the next person that called said, my mother always put hominy in it. So the traditions and the food ways of people from many countries can be transferred here, and if you travel in this country to places that offer, if you've been in Texas, you've had some of the best, have had some of the best Mexican food that you're ever going to have.
And if you're aware that in Vietnam, for example, for the pho, which is the popular soup that they have there, if you're aware of the fact that there are three different distinct broths, there are ones from southern Vietnam, one from the center of Vietnam, and one from the north, and if you know people, because we've had a large population of Vietnamese since the end of the Vietnam War, and the original came over from the southern part. So then you learn that because the broths taste different, and it's like you start talking about it, and it's like it's because it's from different parts and it has different back notes.
Well, let's talk about that, because you've written about Vietnamese restaurants, and you recently wrote about this. It's Pho Hung in East Charlotte. This is a Vietnamese noodle shop. Mm-hmm. Pho is a rice noodle, is that correct? Or is that the broth?
Pho is a soup.
Okay.
Soup. It's the when you talk about pho, you talk about the soup itself.
But, so which version of the broth do they serve?
So there, it's more of the northern variety, but they're also serving these great soups there from the central part of Vietnam, which we haven't really seen here before, which is just interesting. But one of the interesting parts of what are you going to talk about, Mike?
I saw a note from the producer where you said that we should talk about one of these soups, which is full of, congealed pork blood, which you say, I think, might gross Mike out. How right you are. Talk about that, please. I'll leave the room.
I really admire communities that if you're going to devour an animal, devour all parts of it. And you have to think about it. Congealed pig's blood, which kind of looks like tofu and tastes not that dissimilar, but it tastes. But, you know, there are blood sausages in Europe.
Yes, yes.
You know, and people wake up and they do this. So it's not, and I love the fact that people have the chutzpah to serve it. Because a lot of Americans will look at it and like, no, I don't think so. Or, you know, you can always get it without that.
Okay. Too. Where is Fohong?
It's over on Eastway Drive near Independence and Eastway. Okay. Over by the Shomars and that little neighborhood over there.
I will add for people, for the general listening population, if a place opens serving the food of their native land, go right away. Because that is your best shot at getting the broadest menu, the most number of dishes, before it is discovered that charlatans really don't want to buy this whole
So then they range of things.
And then they pare down and pare down and pare down. Little Turkish place opened and they had amazing, all kinds of amazing stuff. 3 months later, they had half as much. Mm-hmm. 6 months later, it was closed. So go right away. Support people who are offering diversity in Charlotte.
Well, as long as we were talking about noodle restaurants, you found, and you already mentioned, Futo Buta, is that how you say it?
Yes.
And you've called it a find.
It means fat pig.
Okay.
And I figured you'd like the pig thing, since we seem to be on a pig thing.
And you said slurp it up. Both of you have reviewed this. Slurp it up. So these are Japanese noodles, not Vietnamese noodles, correct?
Yes.
What's the difference?
That is correct. So ramen is a whole culture unto itself.
Yes, and particularly here in college.
Yes. So,
that's a
brilliant. That is not ramen. So let's be clear. If your experience of ramen is the five for a dollar, and I knew someone who worked for years on five for a dollar ramen packages. I'm making the international ramen package symbol with my hands. That's not ramen. That's not what we're talking about. So go to Futo Buta and try it, because that also has several different bases for broths and different additions. And the chef owner there, who is actually planning to also open a pizza place that I'm highly interested in, is the opening chef for Baku in the South Park area, and has had lots of experience in and has traveled extensively. And this is Charlotte's first ramen house. I mean, it's the first time where we've had ramen on menus as sort of a highlighted item or something to play with, because chefs love it. Like we've talked about, chefs love sushi. Here he's committed and he does some other things, but it is the star of the menu, and that's the first time we've had that. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting. Tiny, tiny place on the light rail line.
Where?
At Bland.
Oh.
So Bland and the light rail line, it's on the backside of the light rail side, but its street address, like if you plug that in your phone, you're never going to find it. So park on South Boulevard or park in that complex that's at Bland and South, and then walk toward the light rail, and you're going to find it.
Like where the Krispy Kreme is.
Straight back from Krispy Kreme.
In that same building?
It's in that
corner?
Same building, right?
Yeah, it's on the other side of the
parking deck. I'm spatially challenged, so you have now just exhausted my hope for direction.
But then, I mean, it's before you get to that complex of bars and where the Greek Isles restaurant used to be. It's before you get to that.
Right.
Okay.
Depends on which way you're going, but...
Yeah. Yes,
exactly. If you're coming from South Boulevard, let's put it that way. You're the one that's spatially challenged, not me.
But it's exciting because it's on the... You can see it from the blue line. You know, it's like it's okay. That's great.
Well, you know, you can see lots of things from the Blue Line, and you can see the Blue Line from lots of places, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about next, and that is outdoor dining. There was an article this morning in the paper by Helen Schwab about al fresco dining. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't restaurateurs have to fight to get outdoor dining?
That was sidewalk dining.
That was
permission to have tables on Tryon Street, basically. People fought for that. Outdoor dining is certainly that counts. So you have tables now on Tryon Street, but we're talking about patios and terraces and all sorts of spaces beyond that, too. Top floor places like rooftop patios in particular, which is on the cover. I'm trying to see if that's where I think it is. Peculiar Rabbit is maybe my favorite one in town because that is an unparalleled view of the skyline from a distance. Fahrenheit is stunning. If you want to be right amid the buildings, stunning, stunning. Best thing about it.
Well, that was going to be my question. Best thing about it. I'm going to quote you now, although it was silent by far. When you're looking for outdoor dining, are you really looking for the atmosphere, or ideally are you looking for a good marriage between atmosphere and food? Or does it matter? You're just outside, the weather is nice, the view is beautiful, that's enough. Is that enough?
Historically, I think that there's a lot of places that will, you know, the place that's on the ocean, the place at the top of the building, I think that people go there for the view first, mm-hmm. and then everything else is secondary. Maybe drinks come second. Before the food even.
Is that a self-fulfilling prophecy, for lack of a better word? In other words, if you're the proprietor of an establishment that has this beautiful outdoor dining space, can you rest on your laurels when it comes to the food?
I would say some do. I don't think everybody does.
Can you stay in business for a long amount of time?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
So where would you say the best places to go to experience the view and outdoor dining, but also get a good meal would be?
Well, I put a handful in this story. I think we have some really nice spots. I'm kind of excited about a couple that are getting ready to open, too. There's a place called Sea Level that is going into the Hearst Tower, and that is from Paul Manley and Jeff Tonadandel. I'm sorry, Jeff, whatever. I don't mean to butcher your last name, who opened Growler's Poorhouse in the Crepe Cellar. And it's really an interesting story. Paul, in particular, is really interested in seafood and has spent some time talking about oysters and learning about oysters. And they are now having an oyster cultivated that is, for lack of a better word, a little bit customized. It's been served at Growler's, I think it is. And I have a link in the story, if you go to it online, that tells a little bit more about that. But Sea Level will be similar to what Rock Salt has done, very much seafood focused, farm to table. We know everyone that we're bringing in. We know they're either the fisher folk or the farm raised seafood. And I think with the reputation that these guys have, I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be really
interesting.
Will they
be high in the tower, or will they be at street level?
No, street level.
Street level.
Street level.
Where
City Tavern was. Yeah. Sea Level, ba-dum-ba. It's actually named not, although that would be cool, Sea Level, North Carolina, which is where a lot of it is going to come from. So I'm really excited about that one. I think that one's going to be a good blend, and I think those guys have done a really nice job at Crepe Cellar and Growler's doing things that people want but finding ways to do things that they're really excited about, too. Some great pickles, some great combinations of things, house-blended sausages at Growler's, so good beer, you know, very intentional about all aspects of the experience, which is something that we've been talking about. You know, the service there will matter. I think patio service really matters. So we talked about atmosphere and food. Service on patios really matter, because how many places put you out there and kind of nod at
you
and go, we'll be back, never.
They forget that they have a patio.
Well, or they just don't care because people are out there drinking and they don't figure they really need to do much in lots of places.
I was actually, surprised because you did your homework on this article. There's a lot of stuff in here that I knew, like DJI. I knew they had an outside area, but I never think of it as an outdoor place. You have so many places in this article.
There's so many.
It's unbelievable. So if you want to eat out when the weather is nice, you can do it easily.
Which is now, not the summer. We all start talking about going outside in the summer when it's broiling. Now is a great time to go, particularly with the places that have fire pits or fireplaces, which is more than you would think. I mean, it can be so cozy. It's
or even
just
the
a
heat
great
lamps
time
that they put
yes.
out.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
What did you? I'm sorry, couldn't
the
you?
The heat lamps that they'll put outside
right.
that will, so far into the season, even November.
Yeah.
Well, we want to hear about your favorite restaurants in the next segment. What do you always find yourself recommending to other people? Would be interesting to hear from you on Twitter or Facebook at WFAE, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And when we come back, we're going to name drop some other restaurants that are critic favorites here, and also talk about the phenomenon of chef-driven restaurants and why it is, perhaps, that Charlotte has no James Beard award-winning chef or nominee. That seems to be a bugaboo with some of our critics sitting around the table. Tricia?
Yes.
We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking restaurants. We're talking food with Tricia Childress, restaurant critic for Creative Loafing and an instructor at Johnson & Wales University. Helen Schwab is restaurant critic for the Charlotte Observer. And we asked you what your favorite restaurants were, what you recommend to friends on Facebook, Twitter, and on email. Here's what we've gotten. John emails, the best Mediterranean restaurant in Charlotte is by far Kebab Je. Is that how you say it? J-E? Mm-hmm. Rotisserie and Grill in Matthews, superb Lebanese food. Colin on Facebook, Pho Daravan at East Sugar Creek and Tryon makes fantastic pho. If that's how you say pho.
Pho.
Pho. You say pho, I'll say pho. Let's call the whole thing.
You can, but people will not know what you're talking about.
Okay. Kim on Facebook, Heritage Food and Drink in Waxhaw, Block and Grinder in Cotswold, Earl's Grocery in Elizabeth.
You're looking puzzled, Mike.
No, not at all.
Okay, good.
I'm just looking at you for response because I know you've written about
Earl's
Grocery.
Yes,
Earl's
Grocery. You know, that's Tricia and Bonnie from Carpe Diem.
Right. Megan on Twitter.
And Mark Jacksina. What?
Megan on Twitter writes, Dish in Plaza Midwood. Now, there's an
old-timer. Yep.
Yeah. And Sarah, Fenwick's on Providence, still amazing and family-owned after all these years. Let's talk about some restaurants that you have brought up. And since we had one of the Lebanese restaurants mentioned here, Tricia, you once lived in Northern Africa, and you've mentioned at the last time you were on your program, you mentioned that, but you also mentioned in your review recently for Ashbani Moroccan Cuisine in Plaza Midwood. It's a takeout-only shop.
Takeout-only.
Now, this works for Thai Thai on East and Kenilworth. Mm-hmm. How does it work there?
You know, they're on a different kind of learning curve for Moroccan food. Because, I mean, I was just there this week, and again, they're still educating. So what is this? You know, because Moroccan food, we don't see it that much. There's another place that's up at the university, and we do not have a large expat community. Mm-hmm. But this is very flavorful, more sweet, hot, a lot of fruits, stews.
And they're offering tastes, which I think is brilliant. And so at Ashbani, they'll give you a taste of things.
Yeah.
Ah, smart.
But you can,
yeah,
at the place
really
smells
smart.
Amazing. I mean, it's so
really
hard not smart. To buy things when you get in there because it's like going into a Moroccan spice shop. You know, it's great. But Kebabja is just, you know, they're changing in such a positive way. It is a great thing for Matthews.
Since the cuisine is so different, how do you know what to get? Obviously, you can taste, but how do you know how much to get? And what varieties to, and you know, because sometimes I've learned through tapas experiences that sometimes you leave stuffed, other times not so much. So how do you know how much to order if you don't know what it is?
Well, the Moroccan place isn't small plates. So small plates have really kind of played with people here. It's very challenging because the tapas idea of ordering many small plates and sampling a lot of things is executed really differently restaurant by restaurant here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of places have tried to embrace the small plates idea and then confused people by saying, so you should order three apiece. And you just can't say you should order X number for people because you don't know how they eat. And people end up either over-ordering or they're really angry because they didn't get enough food. And the whole idea is to order it, eat it. Are you still hungry? Order another one. That's the idea. So I think if people understood that a little more and were more comfortable with, you don't order everything at on the front end and then wait and then eat it all and then decide how you feel. It's European in that you eat as you go and how are you feeling? And okay, so let's adjust. So that would be my recommendation anywhere that offers small plates. Order a few, see how it goes, order some more. The Moroccan place isn't small plates, so you're ordering your meal, your entree. And when you don't know, I mean, it's nice to have a taste. It's a guessing game. Try something mild and that seems pretty safe to you if you're trying a new cuisine. And if you like it, continue to try things. Try to go with several other people so that you can all get something different and everybody tries something. Ask if they'll do. Well, I always order a lot, but I'm on somebody else's dime. I think for people who aren't, it makes sense to ask always, particularly these small places that are owned by a family. Could I have a little bit of everything and would you charge me $10 for a bit of all four of these entrees? Hmm. Ask that. Lots of places are happy to do that. So, lots of places aren't because their production does not allow it. But always ask. You get so much goodwill by showing interest in the food. If you care and you are genuinely interested, typically people who are in this business want to share what they do with you. They can't wait to share. Let them have that opportunity.
There's a lot of the soup shops that they'll let you take the child's portion so you can get a variety of soups.
Oh, that's very cool. I don't know which one of you wrote about this. Forgive me, but my eyes like to bug out of my head when I read this. There's a new restaurant that will be opening in Belmont that will be run and owned and operated by the Jonas Brothers' father.
Well, why are you bugging out of your head?
Not just the Jonas Brothers in Belmont don't equate for me, so that just.
They're from the Carolinas.
I didn't know that.
It's a powerful story of success, and no, I don't know. they were actually auditioning singing waiters, which gives me
serious?
Pause. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be called.
But it could work.
It's going to be called Nellie's Southern Kitchen, and I'm told that the Jonas Brothers themselves actually come back every once in a while because they enjoy being there. So, is Belmont in fact their hometown?
I don't remember, and my apologies to Nick and Joe. I'm sure you're listening. I'm sorry, I can't remember. I know they grew up in the Carolinas. I know there is Nellie's, the grandmother, and they're talking about Southern food as per her recipes. I do not remember if that's specifically where they're from or not. It's in the story, so if you Google it, my name and Nellie's Kitchen, it ought to come up.
Has it opened yet? Has not opened
yet. It has not opened yet. Okay. It has not.
You write a lot about, Tricia, the James Beard Award and the fact that we don't have any James Beard Award winning chefs here and no chef here has been nominated for a James Beard Award, which is the restaurant industry's Oscar. Mm-hmm. Why is that important?
It's important because it is one of those defining marks for our community. And we have a really large restaurant community. We have had a lot of talented chefs here in Charlotte now and prior to now. And we've had chefs who have moved from here and been nominated. We have chefs who were born here and have won. And it's just kind of a curiosity to me why Charlotte seems to be this little mark on the map that is not being recognized.
You call it puzzling. Do you find it worrisome?
Not worrisome, but I think that I take to heart what Chris Hastings, who is a chef who owns Hot and Hot Fish Club in Birmingham, he's a Charlottean, and I talked to him at great lengths about, you know, why. And he said, you know, if Charlotte doesn't care, it's not going to happen.
Does Charlotte not care?
I will take issue with that. I don't think that's why at all. I don't think it has anything to do with people not wanting one. I think it has everything to do with a number of factors. Chief among them being that Charlotte is not a destination, a tourist city in the way that other places, nor is it a hub of travel.
Birmingham?
So what that means, well, pause. Birmingham is to some degree. What that means is that you've got to come here on purpose. You've got to come here on purpose to try food, and you are typically only going to try it one time. It's not as if you're in New York and you're trying everything. Right. It's not as if you have. So from a voter perspective, because this is not like the Oscars, so just to disabuse you of that notion, it's not even like the Tonys. It's the Oscars are nominated by people in that field only.
Okay.
And then voted on. I ran through this with Larry because I got so tired of people saying it's the Oscars of food, because it's not. It's intended as the only national recognition. I mean, I think that's where they kind of take it from. But the voting process is nothing like the Oscars.
Oh no, I know that. I know. So,
yeah,
I know
no. But I'm not telling you. I'm saying to the general listening public that it's so that's off a little bit. Voters don't have to have gone to any of the restaurants to vote for the restaurants, and so by its very nature, restaurants and cities have a leg up that are more known, that are more traveled through. So that's one element of it. Another element of it is that because we are not a tourist city and destination, we do not have incredibly challenging menus, and haven't for the last 20 years, which is a thing that Beard likes. So I'll go on record here, I guess. It's exciting. As saying, I think Joe Kindred is very likely to be the first nominee, because Kindred has all the pieces of the story.
I would agree with that. But part of my concern has been that Charlotte has not owned its own. It's the idea of being proud of what is here, of the idea that, because Joe's been around, this is not his first place. And while he may have been working for someone else and putting out food that maybe someone else wanted, I mean, he's a really talented chef, but he was at Nobles, and he was at Roosters, and he was at other places too. But it's the idea of recognizing and being able to trust what we know. If something tastes good, it just tastes good. It shouldn't make any difference if you're in New York City, if you're in Charlotte, if you're in Miami, if you're in Portland. If something tastes good, it just tastes good. And it seems like a lot of times people will not be, and I don't mean all rah-rah Charlotte, but I do know a lot of chefs that are really frustrated here because they've been putting out really good products for a long time, and it seems like there needs to be much more of an appreciation for what people do here.
Well, so it's just a separate issue from the Beards is what I would say.
Kindred in Davidson has gotten national recognition. It was on Bon Appetit's top 10 national restaurants list earlier this year. Where do the two of you put it? I know you rank it as number one. Do you not, in Charlotte, on your list?
You know, I don't keep a list because I don't believe in keeping.
Where did I get that then, I wonder?
I wrote about it quite a bit and said that, I mean, when they were getting ready to open, we laughed about saying, is this the one? Is this the one?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's got national experience.
Right. That's true.
But what he's also got beyond the talent, because absolutely he has the talent, he has a story. Mm-hmm. The menu tells a story. The place tells a story. His family tells a story. There's a story there. And as with any award, a story makes all the difference. And when you're in a place like Charlotte, a story really makes all the difference. So,
well, since we don't appreciate what we have here in many cases, does the fact that Five Church, which is recognized as being a pretty doggone good place to go eat, the fact that they're opening in Charleston, will that give it some elan?
I just like the fact that a Charlotte address is going to be in Charleston.
In Charleston, yeah. Do they have a Church Street in Charleston? They probably do.
Sure they do.
Miller writes, my wife once dated a great chef who worked at places like Danielle in New York City and others. Where can I take her for a special dinner that will be up to her standards and meet her expectations in Charlotte? I've tried and failed. She is never critical, but I can see it in her face that she enjoys all types of cuisine.
So I need to talk to you, Miller, off
air. We have
less
than a minute.
call my office, Miller, right? Because
yes.
We should have a conversation off air about why that is and what we can do about that.
Okay. Well, in 30 seconds or less, Tricia Childress and Helen Schwab, top restaurant for you. Go.
Well, my new favorite restaurant is Tamarind.
That's the Indian restaurant, and that's where?
It's out on Independence near 51.
Okay. Helen?
And I will send people to Kindred unapologetically, because you ought to be driving up to Davidson anyway. If you don't live there, you ought to be going up there and checking it out. they've got a patio. I did not put them in this story.
Okay. Helen Schwab is the restaurant writer for the Charlotte Observer. Trisha Childress for Creative Loafing. She's a restaurant critic there and associate professor at Johnson & Wales University. Always fun to have you here. Thank you so much.
We enjoyed it, Mike.